I think we really liked MASH growing up and watched that quite a bit. I really liked MASH, and we watched it a bunch of times and really enjoyed it.
MASH being the TV show?
No, no, sorry. Good point. And I'm glad you're on the podcast. Born in 1996, Taylor.
I thought we were actually going to have an intermission.
Unless Balls. You're a low-T soy boy.
And various long-haired hippie trash who think that he's... And we're back. Hey, guys.
Woo!
Welcome back to another episode of the Crowded Theater Podcast. As always, I am Kyle.
I am Taylor.
And I am Cliff.
That's right. We are, Cliff and I are brothers. We are filmmakers. Taylor, you are my fiance. We see a lot of movies in theaters and we talk about them here. That's basically the podcast. I think we can move on. We actually have something cool to talk about, which is, first of all, how are you guys doing? How you been?
Good.
How's this week going? Good.
Pretty cool week.
It has been. We've seen some good movies. They are doing a 1974 series. We have a 1974 double feature today. They're doing a 1974 series at the Alamo Drafthouse right now. And we saw two movies. We saw two movies, one a favorite of ours, and one an old kind of a favorite, but one that we always felt was kind of long and boring, but we were happy to revisit in a theatrical context. That is
when you say the words long and boring, the movie that possibly comes to mind is...
Godfather Part 2.
There you go.
But we saw Godfather 2, which I've saw many times growing up, and we also saw, just to kill the suspense here, one of our favorite comedies, one of our favorite Robert Altman movies, California Split, starring Elliot Gould and George Segal, and we have lots and lots and lots to talk to say about that.
Yes, we do.
Indeed. Taylor, what was your reaction? Because you went in cold to California Split. What was your cold reaction to California Split?
I tend to really like gambling movies or anything, movies about gambling. I think it's a very fun icon to kind of play around with movie-wise. Yeah. It was an interesting movie. I kind of went into it cold for better and for worse. So it was
Had this interesting moment because I think that this is not your first Robert Altman movie, but I don't think you have seen enough Robert Altman movies to develop a concept for kind of what you were going to be kind of having to anticipate going in. Mm-hmm. So I think you had that. I think when they dropped the checks at the Alamo, you told me later on, you said, "How could this movie be almost over? Like, I'm still waiting for the plot to emerge, etc." Like, you know, and it didn't. Which I think speaks to the fact that the movie. What I enjoy about the movie is I like that. Like Robert Altman at his best, the movie feels like this sort of energetic ride where you're mm-hmm. just sort of off and hanging out with these characters, and it's episodic, and you're kind of cutting around between a bunch of different stuff. But anyway, so we'll kind of get into all of that over the course of it. But I was kind of curious what your reaction would be. I didn't want to like kind of
tee you up for anything.
I'm glad we saw it with, and this is true of both the 74 films. A crowded theater. That's right.
It's the title
of the podcast, you guys. And I got to say, it is pretty remarkable that I've seen California Split maybe in the theaters once before. I don't remember, but I've seen it a bunch at home. And, you know, we literally were talking when we bought tickets about, you know, it'll be cool to see it on the big screen, even if we're literally the only people in the fucking theater. And we ended up showing up to a mostly full theater at the Alamo. Which was fantastic because people were laughing and reacting to the mm-hmm. movie the whole time.
Fuller, unfortunately, than here. Everyone exactly. see here if it's still in theaters yes. in your area. Yeah. Check out here.
Finally putting that, releasing that podcast today as we're recording this one, or tomorrow, I guess. But yes, hopefully, we haven't checked. I would like to see here another time in theaters. And hopefully, and maybe, hopefully, fingers crossed, there'll be some sort of award show bump or something where they'll like stick it in a few theaters for more screenings at the end of the year or something like that. I don't know. But go see here if you can. It's a really good fucking movie. So we saw California Split with a crowded theater, which was a new experience for us, which was fucking awesome. And then we revisited Godfather 2 for the first time in a while, as it is the 3.5 hour Godfather with, you know, less cool stuff in it. I know that we were kind of talking about how when we grew up, there was this kind of a perennial debate about whether or not Godfather 1 or 2 was the better film, because obviously Godfather 2 came out to great acclaim and was also won Best Picture, which is pretty remarkable for a sequel. And yet, I think with distance and time, the instincts, perhaps, Cliff, that we had when we were kids were correct. What were our instincts when we were kids?
Our instincts when we were kids is, yes, obviously The Godfather 1 is the better movie. And our instinct, even as kids, it was the much more engaging, compelling story that we rewatched a whole bunch of times. Yeah. And Godfather 2 is a movie we saw, like, once, okay, another time, and then kind of... Stop
two VHS
that.
Tapes worth of Godfather part
two. VHS tapes worth of Godfather. You had to change it in the middle at the intermission. And I think that I think maybe one of the reasons that folks could say that it held up in the debate for a while as to which was the better movie is that Godfather 2 is definitely a much bigger budget, much slicker production. France, it's not, you know, Godfather 1 is sort of rough around the edges. That's kind of low budget kind of shows.
They certainly have a lot of fucking money to spend in Godfather 2 with all the big street scenes, which are amazing. And by the way, it's not, none of this is to say that Godfather 2 is a bad movie. It is actually a pretty incredible, fantastic, big novel of a film. But at the same time, it does suffer from direct comparisons, I think, to Godfather 1, because I was actually... when we were kind of preparing for this, someone I said, and this they were saying this as praise of Godfather Part 2, but it actually, I think, is a key to what the thing that makes it a little bit lesser than the first film is they say, well, really, Godfather 2 is the full intellectualization of all of the themes present in the first film. And I'm like, boy, is it. You know, it's like, I don't know. It's like, what, and I think we'll kind of get deeper into it here in a second. Of course, I do want to talk about a little bit of California Split first, and then we'll get deep into Godfather 2. But I think that what, if to sum up feelings on Godfather 1 versus 2, Godfather 1 embraces the fact that it's a gangster film, and that's what keeps it on the fucking rails. All of these themes and all of these the satirical ideas about America and all of the familial ideas, they all kind of go through this filter of it's a gangster movie. Like, cool gangster shit's happening. There's a tight gangster plot happening the whole time. And through that prism, it makes all of that stuff great and resonant. Whereas now that they had all the money and all the time and all the whatever in the world, and this would become perhaps a problem, we can maybe talk about Megalopolis a little bit at the end of this as well, which just came out. When you have all the money and all the time and all of that, it does become an intellectualization of the themes. Because if you're not trying to make it a wildly entertaining and a genre film, you know, you end up putting most of the good shit in the first half of your 3.5-hour movie and then having the back half be a lot of like political hearings and like long divorce arguments, which were very
invoked. Sounds a lot like Oppenheimer.
Yes, fuck it, yes, exactly, yeah.
But honestly, Godfather 2 feels a lot like Oppenheimer.
You
it's
are
like
right.
All the shit you remember from Oppenheimer is, you know, that was cool, everything leading up to the bomb. Kind of happens in the first half, but in Godfather Part 2, if you saw it a while ago, your vague notion of it is probably like, at least for the Michael Corleone plot line, is, you know, everything leads up to the Cuban Revolution or something, and then things wrap up pretty quickly after that. And no, it's before the intermission. Before the intermission, we have the Cuban Revolution, and then things keep going
picturing Godfather grabbing Fredo by the face and kissing him and saying, like, I knew it was you, Fredo, and that
you
plays,
broke my heart.
You broke my heart, and you're like, fuck yeah. And then you forget that that plays better almost in a trailer for Godfather 2 because it happens like an hour into a 3.5-hour movie and Fredo dies so much later in a way that is actually cool and in every way does parallel Carlo's death in the first film, but it's deeper and it's his brother. I get it. It's cool. The two films parallel each other in a lot of ways. That's rad. But at the same time, most of the energy, like you can imagine a movie with a lot of the same content, and we'll get into it later when we go deep on this film. We're not there yet, obviously, but... but the idea is that you know, you could imagine a film with this Cuban Revolution and this war with these other gangsters and everything building towards some sort of big energetic climax, not unlike we discussed with Megalopolis the other day. And yet instead we have a greatly slowed down, very diffuse meditation on those themes that doesn't really push them through the lens of any particular genre. And with it, anyway, so we'll get to that in a minute. But let's talk about California Split for a minute, you guys. Cliff, our relationship to Robert Altman has changed over time. I think we really liked MASH growing up and watched that quite a bit. I really liked MASH, and we watched it a bunch of times and really enjoyed it.
MASH being the TV show?
No, sorry. Good point. And I'm glad you're on the podcast, born in 1996, Taylor. Because, no, I am referring to the movie MASH, which is the film on which the TV show was based, which was directed by Robert Altman and had a different cast. Donald.
It was his first movie, wasn't it?
It was his first movie. It's a great story, by the way, about Robert Altman's whole career. He directed TV, was kind of blacklisted for being difficult to work with and a bunch of other things, and then eventually, at like 46, makes this sort of counterculture, cool, hip movie, MASH, where these cool counterculture surgeons are, you know, pulling pranks and palling around in this hilarious comedy that's also full of blood and social commentary, and it was a huge, huge, huge hit and a huge sensation. So suddenly this 46-year-old divorced alcoholic guy is like this hip counterculture filmmaker.
Yeah.
And so that's how you eventually arrive at California Split, like four or five movies later and all of that. But
what? Roger Altman's an alcoholic? I could have never guessed.
Yes, you never could have guessed. And a gambler, by the way.
Oh, I definitely couldn't have seen that coming.
One thing that might be slightly more surprising, though, huge pothead.
Yes.
Later in life, once he switched to pot, this is where I thought you were going, our relationship with him has changed. Over the years.
Oh, that's true. That is also when we saw him
as kids, we were thought his movies were really compelling, but somewhat confusing, the fact that many of the shots and lines seemed not to have any literal connection to what was going on, but seemed to somehow add to the overall whole. And now,
and then,
as we are much older, and then, after becoming potheads...
The spice.
After consuming the spice... we realized, yes, he was alcoholic for a while during his TV days, but then in his 40s started smoking the ganja. Going down the Greenway.
Yes,
and that you could say it influenced his style.
Yes,
you
could say that it's a surprise that Robert Altman, you know, smoked a lot of pot too.
That's
unless
so funny.
You've seen McCabe and Mrs. Miller, in which case it seems like, especially when you watch the first act of that movie, just like. Did they put some crazy fucking pothead in charge of this production and just chaotic people talking over each other and horrible sound? And it's I literally saw McCabe and Mrs. Miller. I remember, like, in college, I went to a screening of McCabe and Mrs. Miller that some professor was showing, and I walked out after the first like 20 minutes. I was like, well, this is just garbled nonsense.
The problem was you at that point were not yet walking the green path.
That's right. And then suddenly later on, I tasted of the spice, and then like if you can hear it now, like Inagata DeVita starting to kind of play in the background. And then finally, as the camera spirals around in circles, I watched McCabe and Mrs. Miller some of the other films, Long Goodbye, for the first time, and was like, oh, I get it now. I get it. It's about all that little stuff. Anyway, but I think that in his filmography, California Split's a really interesting movie because we were just talking about stuff like McCabe and Mrs. Miller. So he becomes this hip powder counterculture filmmaker. He makes a bunch of movies. Some of them are very chaotic, but he's developing this very clear new style where everything has this chaotic, improvisatory feel that feels as raw as something that might be documentary-like, but it's controlled and it's funny and it's weird. And again, I know this is something that maybe is as interesting to other people as it is to me, because it's more than just about technology. It's about kind of how the evolution of the film aesthetic changed. But this is the first film where they started using lavalier microphones going into a multi-track mixer. Now, if you don't know anything about like how film sound is recorded, it's recorded a lot with boom mics and overhead mics and sometimes mics that are planted and things. And there are also lavalier mics, which were a new technology. That's what most people have these days. Most YouTubers use. That is to say, a mic hidden under your clothes that you put onto your person.
Not us, of course. We are using the slightly more primitive technology of the blue mic.
That's right. We're holding these big, stupid blue mics to our faces, like people in some weird future movie, just talking into balls for no reason.
Balls.
We should hide them in the plants. We have these plants up here. We should just talk into the plants like in the old days.
That's right. Just like, Singing in the Rain. We'll just, that's right, exactly. But, so what's interesting, though, is that, you know, Robert Altman, who had all this crazy cross-talking and everything in his films, uses in this film something that took advantage of two emerging technologies, lavalier microphones and with multi-track audio recorders, you know, which were a new thing. And the people in studios and rock and roll were using all these multi-track recorders. And he runs the two things together such that you could have a crowded scene, as you see several times in this film, with multiple people in the frame, be recording a separate, semi-clean audio channel from under the clothes of each one of those individual people. And in post-production, therefore, mix up and down individual tracks and everything. So you could do the same thing that a filmmaker could have previously done, say, with a lens racking focus from a focal plane to of an actor in the foreground to the background. One could almost do an aural or audio rack focus and change from one conversation to another conversation very effortlessly in the frame. And you see this several times in California Split, like to kind of almost show off that idea very early on when Elliot Gould and George Segal's characters are first getting drunk together and first meeting each other. Their conversation is sort of bookended by a conversation between a stripper or a prostitute and a bartender, and the stripper is borrowing like $20 to go give to her girlfriend to go pay the rent or to go gamble with or something like that. Yeah,
her I forget.
Something like that. And they
or was she just calling her mama?
Yeah, or
was
she just calling her mom? Mm-hmm. We're not sure. Yeah. But again, very weird and ambiguous relationship.
Bottomless stripper. You don't see those too often. Sweater up top, bottomless.
Yes, just wearing a shirt, but her butt hanging out. And what's funny is that conversation plays out over the top of their conversation, initially in little fragments that we hear, but then later on with her going and talking to the bartender, and in the mix, we are hearing both conversations, but where they mix up the stripper talking to the bartender, so we can hear that for a second or two before then being drawn back a second later to George Segal and Elliot Gould saying, "Captain Midnight," and coming back and playing with this stuff, which really is not necessarily something that caught on a lot in Hollywood because it is kind of confusing and stuff like that, and I can see why some people were off put by it, but as an aesthetic tool in the toolbox, I mean, it's indispensable. Now, versions of that are happening all the time where we're count on the fact that we can individually record different people and kind of mix their audio and do all of that kind of stuff. So it's very cool to see him playing with that, and it's the perfect filmmaker to actually take advantage of that because he was trying to create these kind of, I mean, so to kind of sum up for those people who don't know, California Split is a film about gambling, so it largely takes place in rowdy, crowded gambling halls and racetracks and pool and casinos at the end. Places where there's a ton of people gathered around a roulette table, or a ton of people gathered at a on a bus, you know, on the way to the track, arguing over seats, or there's a ton of people gathered together inside of this big, fantastic, like,
it's so funny that you say that. Now that you say that they're on the bus to the gambling, I'm like, oh yeah, I just took for granted. I'm like, they're on a bus. Maybe they're going home. I don't know.
They're all at the racetrack, which is why, and I love the film leans into this, because again, the themes of the film talk a lot about, you know, superstition, and I mean, the film is about action. It's about this almost godlike spirit of this action that they're constantly chasing, almost like a muse. So on the bus, you see them debating about what seats to choose, because one girl says she'll get sick if she faces backwards, but it's all based on luck. You know, it's like, if I change seats, I'm not going to win today at the track. And then this girl changes and switches around everyone's seats, and then that is the girl who Elliot Gould talks out of betting on Egyptian Femme, and then he bets on Egyptian Femme, and Egyptian Femme wins, and all of that kind of stuff. So it all factors into the luck of it all and all that kind of stuff. But anyway, because this is a film that takes place in all that stuff, it uses the lavalier mics very well and all that kind of stuff, because you can like you can have just a wide shot of a bus and then just be zeroing in on these little conversations, which was just creates a new aesthetic, you know. Anyway,
a new feeling, kind of like floating through the scene a little bit more authentically.
Yeah, it creates this weird kind of aesthetic of verisimilitude, of it being very extemporaneous, of it just being kind of a moment, you know. And that also enabled him to kind of shoot these chaotic moments and run around and suggest things and change things and allow actors to improvise and change lines and do all that kind of stuff and have some sort of, you know, way of making sense of it in post, which he didn't have as much when he was making McCabe and Mrs. Miller.
Yeah, kind of an interesting God's eye perspective too, where you like you imagine God when looking into the world,
yes,
actually has to discern and focus what mm-hmm. to pay attention to as you're watching the movie.
Yes.
It requires a little bit of work mm-hmm. to find whatever's the relevant bit of information in the thing, and you have a yeah. lot of options of what to look at and sort through, but you feel smart for figuring it out.
Yes, yes.
Even though if you don't subtly don't notice things like the racking of the audio,
even though you're being guided
the
whole time,
you're being guided, gently guided the whole time.
Yes, no,
by
for
the,
sure.
By the rack focuses, both of camera, mm-hmm. zooms of camera, and racking of the audio.
Oh yes, no, it's very, very, very cool. What were you going to say?
I was going to say, Cliff, I know you've seen this movie a bunch of times. Is there any movie or any scene in the movie with the lavalier mics or any kind of tech involved that you thought was interesting this time catching the movie on theater? Is any scene have new light for you?
Nothing like that, but I can just say seeing it in a theater just made that work so much better mm-hmm. than it does seeing it, you know, at home on DVD with a kind of shaky sound bar and all mm-hmm. that. You know, just being immersed in, you know, big surround sound speakers mm-hmm. definitely helps mm-hmm. all that work yeah. much, much more effectively.
Yeah,
you can
yeah.
just hear all the distinct sounds a lot more clearly.
Yes.
You really could pay attention to different things that are going on
yeah.
mm-hmm. audio-wise, and also just seeing on the big screen just visually. So yeah, this thing's Robert Altman movies work really, really, really well on the big screen, kind of uniquely because of that.
Yeah, no, and I think that that's another thing where with the big screen, with the kind of extra focus that comes with all of those people watching at the same time, and just with the clarity of it being really fucking big and really fucking loud, you know, you can feel him directing attention to these things, like how the opening argument emerges between the mustached guy who mugs him and takes his money later, and Elliot Gould about the cod that flies off the table. The cod didn't leave the table. It feels like something very organic, though when you're watching on the big screen, it reads very, very clearly, as opposed to, say, if you're watching it on low volume at home and tried to like have the subtitles on and following along, it would not work. And that's, again, what I really dig and what I really appreciate more about Robert Altman as I got older and as I made more movies was the idea that, you know, he's playing with the energy that comes from chaos, that comes from, you know, new and creative shit happening. And if you are only interested in top-down kind of control over every moment that's happening, that's very frightening and that's very weird. But he is very kind of open to that and playing with that and, you know, the whole time. And I know it's just something that... And to that end... The whole, you know, cross-talking and all of that chaos kind of de-emphasizes the textual aspect even of the text. It de-emphasizes the textual aspect of the dialogue and de-emphasizes the textual aspect of the scene, and even the words themselves become something that is sometimes texture, sometimes important, and it's just up to us to gather enough information that we can kind of piece together the movie, etc., as opposed to believing that the only way to kind of, you know, bring the audience to the other side of the screen is with, you know, a set dialogue and with very with clarity and with coverage. This is something with things that could be very clearly read in Netflix subtitles that walk you through everything.
And imagine that opening card game with Netflix subtitles. The lady who's... What is she complaining about continuously? She has some particular complaint.
Uh-huh.
The fat lady with the glasses that she's whining about. Just like a Scorsese character whining about wanting to get the ketchup at the dinner table
that. Everyone has their own particular
side
thing.
Conversations that, yeah, you... Really, yeah, just seeing it on the big screen and especially just makes it much more interesting. And I just can't imagine, just trying to read who do you write the subtitles for? How do you know
exactly,
who the subtitles
exactly,
are for? How
exactly.
are you looking at the screen
yeah.
to see who's talking?
And that's part of the fun of what draws you into those kind of, is even though they're just very, you know, very naturalistic and very, they're all contemporary and banal, like a bus, you know, there are these really interesting tableaus of all these different faces. And part of the fun is being drawn into this conversation. Wait, who's talking now? And then you have to find someone's face among them. It's great. Anyway, so
where's Waldo?
Exactly. So I don't know. It's this interesting thing. So the movie itself, and we've been talking just about the form of it for a while, but let's just to kind of talk about the movie, like the actual characters in the movie. The movie stars two characters named Elliot Gould and George Segal. The characters probably have other names. I don't really know what they are.
Same.
Let me see. That's probably an unsatisfactory answer. Apparently, George George Segal's character's name is Bill Denny, and Elliot Gould's character's name is Charlie Waters. But we will be referring to them as George Segal and Elliot Gould for the remainder of the podcast, because it doesn't matter. And what I mean by that is this film is a very interesting film because in some ways George Segal plays our everyman, our POV character, a regular guy who has a regular job. He literally is our POV character when we ultimately make it to his little sleepover scene over at Elliot Gould's place, living mm-hmm. with the two prostitutes, where we're seeing everything through his eyes, scanning this weird world he's found himself in. But what the film kind of takes its time ultimately revealing in any kind of explicit way is that the movie is about this guy who has separated from his old lady. He and his old lady aren't together anymore. A couple people make reference to, are you getting back together with your old lady? So it's a film about a guy who's divorced. It doesn't say it explicitly, but we presume his divorce
separated, has... Separated, at least.
Yeah, he said he's separated. Yes, that's right. But we presume that the separation has... So he's in a kind of limbo, and that's mm-hmm. what the film is about, this limbo. Is he going to go from separated to divorced or get back together with his old lady? But the thing is, the film, in a way that kind of makes everything feel very elemental, we never see any of his before life. We don't get this exposition. We just see two guys around a card table. And while this exposition slowly drips in over the course of the movie and we infer that they are who that we think they are, it's really about George Segal as a guy in a sweater. And that's kind of who he is. And we kind of read into his normalness and being a normal guy. But he's lost in this weird limbo where he's going deeper and deeper, led into kind of Wonderland by this white rabbit that is mm-hmm. Elliot Gould.
Yeah, closest we see to his world is the office where he works, where mm-hmm. we see yes. the brief appearance of a very young Jeff mm-hmm. Goldblum, who we gather is his boss, and he doesn't have much respect for his boss, and that's yep. about all we know of what's going on there.
Was he his boss? That's hilarious. Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah, no respect for the boss.
Yeah, or something, the idea that we
I
see...
I thought he was an intern. Yeah. Oh.
No. Yeah. It's like, I think the first time we see Jeff Goldblum, he asks that... we see George Segal enter the office. The secretary yeah. says, the boss wanted to see you. And he says, thanks. And then walks back up the stairs. And then Jeff Goldblum comes out the door. It's like, did George Segal enter? Said, yeah. Did you tell him he wanted to see me? Yeah, he said thanks or something like that.
Exactly. Line and okay. he goes, which is funny because I remember Taylor brightened up when she saw Jeff Goldblum, and I was like, that's his only appearance in the film. Because he was sort of part of the Robert Altman stock company back then. He's the motorcycle guy in Nashville and all that kind of stuff, which would be his next movie, actually, after this. Mm-hmm. So just a character actor at the time.
But we see very little of that space yeah. other than it is distinct. The only space that is distinctly quiet.
Yes. Yeah.
Not a lot of chatter. It's very yeah. subdued, quiet, the opposite of the Elliot Gould world mm-hmm. of all the noise and chatter.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. We see how, because we enter the movie in a crowded gambling hall, and we see just the story play out just with these two guys meeting each other, getting drunk together, and then continuing their crazy night of getting mugged, gambling, and etc. By the time we make it the next day back to his office, it feels so stiflingly quiet and dead and boring by comparison. And he's hungover and he has sunglasses on, but you can literally just see him like a bored child at school, just sort of rolling around. And he can't even be there for more than like 10 minutes before finally he kind of makes an excuse. Yeah. He says he has to drive out to some other thing to see. He works at a magazine or something. And then he goes right to the track with Elliot.
A photographer for a magazine.
Yes, a photographer.
Which factors in a little bit later.
There you go. And so it's fun. He, there's a text message coming in. I'll get rid of that. All right, anyway. But he goes off and he goes right back to the track where with Elliot Gould and all of that. Now, so George Segal is our kind of separated guy in limbo, and he is sort of pulled into this strange... upside down world of being up all night and gambling like crazy and
chasing
all this other stuff.
That high of a big win.
Exactly. By Elliot Gould, who shows up as Charlie, who, as opposed to a man in a sweater, is a man who wears many Hawaiian shirts. And you can sort of infer a lot based upon his Hawaiian shirt. They even meet because of a fun argument he gets into with the redneck guy. They get into a fight. The guy punches George Segal. As a result, Elliot Gould buys him a beer. beer and then they're getting drunk together. And in every way that George Segal is this kind of lost square guy in a sweater, just sort of sad. He goes from just a guy who's sad and drinking at a bar. And I think that one of the great things that you have in this movie, that you also have with Al Pacino in Godfather 2, is George Segal's incredible ability to just tell us to hold the frame silently by just putting his finger on his lip. And just there's so much going on beneath his eyes in those moments that it doesn't have to tell you anything about his divorced wife or any of that other stuff. After he gets in a fight and we see him sitting at the bar, there's just an extended period of him being depressed in a bar, and there's so much storytelling going on his face that when Elliot Gould from across the bar buys him a beer, and then we see all their beers stacked up, and then they get into a quick back and forth about if they can name the seven dwarves, they're super drunk and they're betting each other money, and they're chasing the action of $20 over who can name the seven dwarves, and then they get mugged shortly thereafter. Elliot Gould's character for the rest of the movie is kind of, again, this almost sprightly or spectral presence. He is action. He is the high of gambling. He's the thing that when he appears, not unlike Forrest Gump, is sort of the spectral presence of the American dream, etc. He's the spectral presence who shows up as this guy who, again, when we actually learn the details of his life, lives with two prostitutes in a house where they eat cereal in the middle of the night like children, and they kind of sleep on couches and live among trash, and he literally is this creature of vice and of the night. And he whisks George Segal away from his pensive lip-pressing sadness into literally saying, "Captain Midnight," and singing the theme song for a cartoon, and talking about the seven dwarves and having all this fun, and then it comes crashing down when they both get mugged a minute later. But for the rest of the movie, when the high is there, Elliot Gould is there. But when the come down happens, what happens? Elliot Gould's character of Charlie disappears, literally disappears in the movie. And
for no discernible reason.
Like, and that's when all of a sudden his debts are coming due, and he has that really tense scene, great fucking scene, yes, with the loan shark, which has always been great, which is so, like, again,
he's in The Driver, isn't he? I think he's the loan shark guy. He's the thug in The Driver with the 45. The Ryan O'Neill Driver movie. He's the main kind of heavy that he has to deal with.
That's good. Thank you for reminding me of that, because I knew we had just seen him in something recently that we rewatched, and I could not remember what it was, but he is really fucking scary in that. And there's just something about how, again, just like in the opening bit, there's so much storytelling going on just on George Segal's face. You don't need to know that we don't need that sequence, you know, where he's racing around trying to put together the money and it doesn't happen. Like, and again, we've seen that. It's like, fine, I don't care, who gives a shit. It's all on his face. And when the guy comes in, he's like, "Wait, you're telling me that, you know, it's payday and you don't have dollar one? I'm going to have to interpret that as a direct shot at me." Like, all that stuff is so tense and so scary, it almost defies the simplicity of the scene that it is as tense as it is. And I think it's because there is some part of us that when we are caught up in that effervescent high of drinking and whatever our vices are, that knows that there's some sort of piper that needs to be paid, some sort of, you know, I don't know what, tax man who's coming to collect. And so there's this weird, like, you feel like a child being reprimanded by your parent in that scene. And then, you know, I don't know. And then, of course, when he finally turns it around is when he finally takes ownership over the idea that I'm gonna win. Elliot Gould literally just arrives back in his window wearing a sombrero and holding a piñata because he's been in Mexico betting on dogs the whole time. Didn't win a thing, but he's unaffected by it because nothing affects him. He's just pure spirit the whole time. And then he goes on to the fantastic third act of the movie where they sell their possessions, put together a little bit of money, go mug that guy.
He's a mag. Magazine photographer, he sells all his camera equipment. He's all in on this. Sells his car, sells everything. Yep. So if this doesn't work out, it's kaput.
It's kaput. And then they go and they find the coolest poker, like kick-ass little backdoor poker game somewhere where he plays against Amarillo Slim, who's a real poker guy, and other guys. And it's a very fantastic scene. We'll get more into it.
And a fun turn of events. Fun, good luck, and I can't think of the actor's name now. The one that went to the Mexico. He is suddenly really cool. Bad luck. He is not he is not beneficial to be at the table whatsoever. Yes. He's got to let the blonde guy just soar on his own.
Yes, which is in itself is really interesting, that idea that he's like only won when Elliot Gould has been around, and yet he cannot win in that final scene until he sends Elliot Gould out, who is just, you know, who's lost, and there's all that great stuff with just, you know, Elliot Gould, who has no money in a casino, and he's a gambling addict, and he keeps just, and he clearly improvising stuff about trying to get money and get credit and borrow this and bet nickels, and again, it's a film very much
bet candy bars.
Yeah, we haven't watched A Long Goodbye yet, I don't think, but it's a movie very much in that, like, when people dig Long Goodbye, I try and suggest that they watch California Split, because it's one of those movies where Elliot Gould kind of created, or at least it was an important influence, let's say, in the chain of energy that, like, Robert Downey Jr. picked up years later.
I could totally see
of
that.
Kind of floating above the movie in this sprightly way, almost just like a mischievous spirit who kind of sees all the events that are going on with a little bit of distance and irony, and yet still feels like a plausible character who is within the story and not like breaking down the fourth wall of the movie. That's a very difficult and weird thing to do, and yet it's like essentially what I mean is Elliot Gould is the perfect actor for Robert Altman, Elliot Gould, that's sort of the best, because in that same chaotic way of just looking for magic that many directors would take advantage of with Robert Downey Jr. in, you know, the future, he would look for that magic with Elliot Gould, and Elliot Gould would be just giving him all this insane magic, like in Long Goodbye. I mean, the buying of the cat food and all of this, it's just constantly funny and interesting and weird and cool, and this whole movie, not only in some ways I enjoy watching this one more than Long Goodbye. I feel like I revisit it more because A, it has a happy ending, which we'll get into in a second, because it's an awesome, fun, uplifting movie, but B,
there's at least 75% less Schwarzenegger present.
I know, Schwarzenegger does not make a cameo, that's true, man. We should maybe like as a slight give like a side Full Metal Jacked award to Schwarzenegger in Long Goodbye for this award, because he's so jacked in that film.
Well, it carries over to the next movie. Like, he, like, gets a free pass for this
exactly,
one.
Exactly. You can only spend so much jackness in one movie, and he had too much, so it paid off. I don't know. I feel like we revisit this one more because I really like George Segal. I grew up with him on Just Shoot Me, the '90s sitcom where he was the boss opposite David Spade and others. And I love him in The Hot Rock and a bunch of other fucking cool movies. And
Look Who's Talking. The asshole boyfriend ditches
Kirstie Alley. That's right. Mm-hmm. No, that's another play. Yeah. So love George Segal. He's fucking great. And so there's just something about him as him and Elliot Gould together, you know, as playing the square. And there's just no better guy at playing that than Elliot Gould in this movie. I don't know. There's just something. George Segal in this movie. There's something about his finger on his lip pensively that just works, and Elliot Gould playing off of him, and there's what kind of typifies that is there's that scene finally when Elliot Gould's trying to get him back on his side, and they're gonna finally go and make go for the big score in Reno, and he does the one-armed piccolo player, feels so wonderful and organic. You really believe all of George Segal's seriousness prior to that, and you believe the laughter, and it's a real authentic moment. Taylor's shaking her head. You don't like the one-armed piccolo?
No, I did. I'm just remembering. And I was like, oh yeah, that was a fun dumb scene.
So the one-armed That's right. It's a dick joke where he has his hand through his pants, not to spoil it for anyone, and grabs the piccolo with his finger dick through his fly, and it's very funny. And you get a genuine laugh out of George Segal. I don't know if they did that organically on set or if he's just a really good actor.
He's a really fucking good actor is the other possibility, really, but either one, yeah.
Yeah, no, it really works. It definitely works. And again, just kind of touch on the movie. The film has just this interesting like spirit about it where, you know, if you believe, and you can kind of see that it is a gambler's movie because it almost never tries to wrestle intellectually with what the movie is about. We'll get to Godfather 2 in a minute. But instead, there is a spirit of action that, and almost a goddess of action that the guys are worshiping and chasing the whole movie, that Robert Altman clearly tells you in those final scenes, you see moment by moment all of the things that one must do to curry favor with the goddess of action, you know, or as, what is it, Lady Luck Be a Lady, you know, with like the Frank Sinatra song. It's like, what is it, you gotta leave with the guy you came in with, Luck Be a Lady tonight. That's a good song. But the idea that there's all these rules about at the end, as he starts to win in the game against against the guys, he tells Elliot Gould, you gotta leave in order for me to win. So as he starts to win, he says, I lost the rhythm of the game, so I gotta go play some blackjack. And you see him playing three rounds of blackjack at a time, or three hands of blackjack, mm-hmm. with like a couple $100 at a time, and continuing to win. But he's keeping this attitude going, and you can tell he's smiling, and he's believing that he can win. And they even have this magical synchronicity that the blackjack dealer's name is Barbara.
Yes,
they have this running phrase that everyone's name is Barbara, because they keep encountering Barbaras. And then he goes from that to roulette, and there's all these rules about keeping the streak going, and he's rolling 11 after 11, and he's getting all this money and all this shit, and then some tourist comes up, and she finally bets. It's like, I want to put $10 on 17, and everyone's like, no! And then she does, and then it's my birthday, and then it breaks the streak and all of that, and then he just wanders off, and there's that amazing sequence. Again, this is what makes the movie great. This is what kind of Robert Altman at his best is, like Robert Altman shooting Elliot Gould and giving him the time to collect all those poker chips and put them in his shoe and fuck around with everyone over at the, you know, exchange and all that. But it's weird because, again, there's a lot of nihilistic movies with downer endings in the 70s. There's a lot of movies that would have had him end, you know, down and out. And yet, you almost feel like there is a semi-religious aspect to this movie, where the movie is almost being made from someone who has experienced mm-hmm. the uncanny touch of the goddess of action, of Lady mm-hmm. Luck, and he wants to now kind of actually tell, I'm not saying he did this on an intellectual level, but almost an instinctual level, that tell the story of one, you know, who, the guy who went for it, the guy who communed with the goddess and was rewarded favorably for having put it all on the line. That instinct that Robert Altman has as a gambler, that if he sold his house and all of his cars and put it all on one roulette wheel, you know, number, that would land on that number, because of the bravery and the pot and the actual mm-hmm. attitude would metaphysically manifest the win. And George Segal somehow knows it in this. And then we have this moment at the end where he goes back, the final moment mm-hmm. between him and Elliot Gould, where Elliot Gould just says, in a kind of to kind of give him some dimension beyond just being this sprite, he says, it's all just bullshit, isn't it, at the very end.
Or it didn't mean a fucking thing.
Or it didn't mean a fucking thing in it. That's right. It's at the end of Busting that he's like, it's all just bullshit or something. He says, it didn't mean a fucking thing, did it? And we realize that, you know, they've kind of come full circle back to where they were. He's just talking about taking their... In the end, George Segal wins, what is it, $80,000. They each get $40,000, mm-hmm. which is 1974 dollars, so that would be about $6 million apiece today. And the... Elliot Gould wants to keep it rolling, wants to keep it going, wants to keep the action going, and George Segal makes that decision because you realize that he kind of sees it for the first time for what it is. He steps away. He's got it back, what he wanted. You know, he's gone into the cave. He's gotten that elixir. He now is going to go home, and that's literally what he says. I think I'm going to go home, and then he walks out with his money, and go home implies a lot. Okay, go ahead.
Oh, yeah, and Elliot Gould asks, where is home, or where do you live? And
exactly.
He doesn't answer.
He doesn't answer. And we realize that, yeah, they know each other in this place, but they have no identity to each other outside of this place, which makes mm-hmm. the thing have this kind of very elemental feeling. And he goes home, which also has a lot of implications about, again, his nebulous state being in this separated, being, will he get divorced, will he go back to his old lady, the implication being that he has settled whatever business he needed to settle with the goddess and is now headed back to home, headed back to his wife mm-hmm. and all that kind of stuff. So cool fucking movie, and just a good fucking time all the way through, especially the scene where they win big and then they go they decide they're going to take Elliot Gould's two prostitute roommates out for the night, but they have a date with an old man in a dress, and then they have to come in pretending to be vice cops to bust the old man in the dress to get him out of there so they can have a good time. And that scene is fantastic normally, but played with an audience, played very, very well.
Played with an audience 50 years later, yes. It is... played differently. Well, differently, but the same.
But the same, perhaps.
I think we're kind of at the same place in culture. Yes, where the culture's kind of test its boundaries in all sorts of weird ways and define what the next phase of culture is going to be and whatnot. So I think 50 years is about a good round number for things to start cycling around to similar things again.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I think that's a really interesting segue to talk about. Not just the next movie, but the series that we were seeing, the 1974 series, put the films in an interesting context because they had a pre-show with interesting clips of like 1974 newsreels talking about Nixon and Watergate and the impeachment of Nixon and all of that kind of stuff. A few little movie things and whatnot. Music videos and other things playing from the time. Which are really cool and also just kind of stimulating in that they made one think about the fact that these films came out in the same year. Made us think a little bit about what people were thinking about in 1974. Mm-hmm. Because we see all this shit about... we first see this newsreel before, I think, California split about Nixon and, you know, and about Nixon being impeached, etc. Then we go to the movie itself, and even Elliot Gould, they're talking about Dumbo. Like, they're talking about all these Disney movies in the beginning, and immediately Elliot Gould is like, but that's not cool anymore, man. Dumbo's not cool because of the black crows. You can't have black crows in a movie. That's racist. Mm-hmm. And it's like, this is 1974. We're dealing with like literally the same shit. The Nixon shit sounds... They're interviewing various conservative people who think that he is awesome and various long-haired hippie trash who think that he is not awesome. And it just, again, feels like it's something that could be ripped off of YouTube today. And then we go immediately 5 seconds into the movie, and there's already this kind of winking, fun, jabbing at the idea that there's already a conversation about Dumbo being problematic. And that was 50 years ago, and look where we've come. So it's a fun thing. And I think that is an interesting segue into talking about Godfather 2, which I even heard Spielberg say Godfather 2 feels much more like it was Francis's movie than Godfather 1. And I think that is true, and I think it is why it is probably a film that felt very white hot of its time, every bit the equal of the first film when it came out. But I feel like in retrospect, certain aspects, especially those aspects that weren't really wedded to the original book, some of the contemporary storylines that were written for the thing feel very 1974.
Yeah.
And they feel in a way that is not bad. They're actually done quite well, I think, and I think the movie is very good, but in ways that make it not feel nearly as timeless or as elementally powerful as the first film. But we'll get into more of that in a moment. Go ahead, Cliff.
Well, I was going to say, yeah, I mean, it's all intelligently done and all that, and and well done. But this is one of those movies where I think it's a weird experience watching it, where every scene individually in and of itself feels like it's well done and beautifully shot, beautifully acted. You're generally engaged by it. But it just feels, I'm reminded of the Fellowship of the Ring line from, Ian Holm. Mm-hmm. Spread thin like butter over too much bread.
Yes, diffuse. Yes,
that
the film feels very diffuse. I do see that why they wanted to stick with one storyline for a long period of time and another storyline for a long period of time, but it does feel diffuse to the point where even the power of the connective tissue, even when you're in a theater and dialed in between moments in the Robert De Niro storyline or in the Pacino whatever storyline, that certain, like the Hyman Roth plot, etc., feels they're separated by hours of screen time to the extent that they lose a lot of their impact and a lot of their power. But I want to just turn it real quick to Taylor as a who has a fresh reaction, because you saw The Godfather in a theater for the first time not too long ago. We saw it at AFS. And then, and you really enjoyed that.
I really did, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And so, and now you're seeing Godfather 2. And how did Godfather 2 leave you relative to Godfather 1?
I really liked it. My number one complaint with all movies is going to be that it was too long.
well,
but
you'd other not than, be alone, perhaps, with this film, but go ahead.
No, of course. But no, I think this movie was really, really good. I think of the two storylines, I was definitely much more engaged and much more interested in the more modern Michael Corleone storyline. Yeah. Not to say anything discouraging of the past storyline. I thought that was also very interesting. It was also the only scene I'd ever seen prior. I just must have caught on some cable news, but like the scene where older Vito kills the guy.
The guy.
Yeah, I've seen that. So that's like literally the only context I knew, which was pretty much all you really needed.
Definitely one of the famous moments in the movie, for sure.
Definitely one of the better, more iconic moments with the. But anyway, yes, very good.
And so
what
attracted you to the contemporary stuff? Because definitely, I think when we were kids, I remember really enjoying all of the olds. Because the story, Godfather 2, ladies and gentlemen, quick synopsis. It tells the continuing story of Michael Corleone as he runs the Corleone family while intercutting back with some stuff which was taken from the original. Mario Puzo Godfather novel about Vito Corleone being a young boy fleeing a gangster in Italy, arriving as Vito Andolini at Ellis Island. He is told that his new name is Corleone because they mistakenly read the name of his town for his last name and write it down, which is a funny little thing because the whole movie is about family, and then we realize that the name is a mistake. Then grows up to be Robert De Niro, and we intercut, and this is what basically the movie that Francis Ford Coppola said he wanted to make was a storyteller. A father's story and a son's story in parallel together. And I think that that's clearly, yeah, that's the intention. But when I was young, I really liked the old stuff with the old Italy and the murder and the Robert De Niro stuff. I found that stuff very captivating. And I probably also because I was a child and
didn't understand all the complex words and
all the complex words
line.
And the other stuff, I was not as interested in the so what was appealing to you about the modern stuff?
I don't know if there's anything specifically that I can put my finger on, but it was just I found that a little bit more engaging. I liked, of all of the characters of the first Godfather movie, I really liked the character of Michael Corleone. I really thought that was an interesting character, and I kind of liked the continuation of seeing what his story was. And even as much as I don't like the downgrade or the downward spiral of a character, his downward spiral was very engaging to watch, for lack of a better word. Just I really liked in the first movie, and maybe it's even beneficial from seeing the first movie so recently, but I really liked seeing him wanting to hold on to his wife, and then the unfortunate spoiler downfall of losing his wife, and just the deterioration of his true family, and etc.
No, I'm with you. I was struck when I started watching it this time, just about how much I was appreciating, it's a fantastic movie. All the storylines are fantastic, the contemporary stuff as well as the stuff in the past. But I was struck much more, by being an adult, being able to slightly more follow what the fuck was going on when I was a kid. So I was able to get more invested in it.
It's a lot of names. A lot of names. You got to pay attention to what those names are in order for the scenes to make sense.
And it does not make it easy on you. But the... but also just struck with, again, Al Pacino's performance as Michael Corleone, which, again, is a very minimalistic performance, and I grew up on, loud Pacino. And so it took me, I was a little bit older before I could appreciate quiet, younger Pacino in the same way. But, again, we were just talking about George Segal's ability to just sort of hold the frame and tell all the storytelling and his moments in California Split. But that is fucking nothing compared to Al Pacino in this movie, who for vast parts of the movie is holding these scenes where there's more shit being discussed around him, betrayals and murders and that sort of thing, and you see his eyes flittering, and while the senator is on stage condescending to him and intentionally fucking up his last name, and then goes to his office and directly challenges him and says, "I don't like you with your greasy hair pretending to be white people coming around here," etc. And just all of the violence and all of the weirdness, like the almost vampiric presence behind his eyes. So he's just softly looking down, and yet there is this tremendous implication of violence behind the idea, and that's why when he stands up and leaves and he says, here is my offer, nothing, not even the fee for the gambling license, I'll thank you for the, that you, I'd like you to pay for it yourself, blah blah blah, at moments like that you're like, fuck yeah dude, this is like Godfather 2. Mm-hmm. It's like every bit as good as the Godfather 1. I am dialed the fuck in, I am ready. We're gonna have a horse head moment coming up. This is just like the producer thing in the first film. That's gonna go back and forth, other shit's gonna spiral out of control. I'm fucking dialed in, and I feel like if the rest of the movie were at like that, mm-hmm. It would be every bit the equal of the first film. But unfortunately, again, things slowly become more diffuse and more intellectual and more textual and political as the film goes on, and those elements feel very diffuse over the course of it. But I mean, in the beginning, goddamn, it is good. And I got, and again, the Hyman Roth plot, all that stuff.
Yeah,
great. You know, when Hyman Roth is first introduced, his whole behavior, the idea that he's just this, that slowly old being guy. Revealed, yeah, the old guy, he's going to be the one of the principal villains of the contemporary storyline, that he's just a guy, he's not at all what you're expecting. He's talked about a tremendous amount. Some people tell him, one guy tells him that, the guy who talks like this, tells him not to trust him at all, and he's a snake, and your father worked with him, but don't trust him. Mm-hmm. And then the other guy comes to him and says he's just a Periezzi, and just tells him to work with him, and you don't know. So there's all this anticipation built, and then we just see him just relaxing.
In a normal suburban house. Exactly. First of all, their drive, it's a lot of anticipation. The drive up to where is this castle where Hyman Roth must live in? Yes. The top penthouse of a skyscraper. No. It's a normal ass. Yep. Suburban street in Miami.
Yes, it kind of anticipates Gus Fring from Breaking Bad, who would show up in Megalopolis, who we brought up, Giancarlo Esposito. But it's so funny because, yeah, he's just like literally watching a football game that we never even see, facing away, has one leg thrown over the side of the chair. There's so much done in this film with chairs, you know, with the different chairs people sit in and their behavior, like Fredo against the water at the end, in that weird reclined chair that's laying back, and he's like, what about me, Michael? And the chair's just sort of bouncing around and he's laying back, or Michael sitting in a black chair wearing a black suit disappearing into an infinity of black at several. So again, just a lot done with chairs, but that's a great chair in that his behavior tells you everything about him. Like, is he trustworthy? Is he not? We don't like the fact that he's this casual around Michael, but then Michael seems so trustworthy of him. He's like, you're going to be, and he says to him, like, you're so wise. There's so much I could learn from you. This guy took a shot at me. This guy tried to kill my family, blah, blah, blah. We then go and we realize this whole time we're suspecting as an audience, this guy, I don't know, his legs slung over the chair, whatever. I don't know if Michael should trust this guy and his side of the story like this. And then we realize a moment later that as well as Michael was selling it, there was a subtext to the performance of bullshit. Like, why would Michael be so effusive about, you're my new father and I want to learn from you? It's because Michael knows that's exactly what Hyman Roth wants, and what the condition Hyman Roth was trying to induce, such that Michael would come to him for advice and believe that the guy who talks like this had been the one who did it, and blah, blah, blah. And then he would use his money to invest in casino operations in Cuba and all of that kind of stuff. And really, I mean, if the Cuban half had been the whole of that movie and then played out to a big thing where there's a Cuban revolution and Hyman Roth gets like shot through the eye and like falls out of a balcony, you know, through a Cuban flag, and then like he's there and like pretty rad, right?
And we even have time for all the Fredo stuff. He finds out, he's already found out that Fredo betrayed him, already has the moment where he kisses him, and then you just have him like two or three scenes later where he offs Fredo, you know?
Exactly. And
take care of all of it.
And you could imagine how well all that stuff would intercut with the rise to power of Robert De Niro and the first stuff, and, you know, again, starting out as this immigrant and building it up and getting shit on by the local, you know, brutal gangster guys who were collecting production money, and standing up against them and killing that guy and everyone showing him respect, and then building to the conclusion of that story. You could see those two stories operating really beautifully in parallel, because everything he's earning in that first storyline is to build this little family of these four kids. Mm-hmm. We can talk, by the way, we should touch on the final scene in a moment, but all of these four boys, and then we see finally in this other story those four boys get torn apart.
And again, what is weird about the movie is not that any part of that is done poorly or that it's bad or any of these other things, but it's the way in which it is dramatized is one in which, and the way in which the two storylines are put together, all that shit happens in like the first half of the movie in the contemporary storyline. And then, and but Hyman Roth doesn't die, and everyone just sort of, the whole Cuban thing just sort of stops, just ends. And then where there's a Cuban, like the communists take over and everyone goes home.
And then cuts back to him in the U.S.
Yeah, just cuts back to literally, like an edit. He comes back, you know. They do a sequence after the intermission, which I think that you might have missed in the...
So we're into the bathroom.
We're into the bathroom.
I thought we were actually going to have an intermission.
Yeah, yeah. So there was, yeah, but they should have potentially done one. But there was a scene where he comes home very much dressed as a dad returning home to his kid. So he's in a trench coat and a fedora, and he has a briefcase with him. And, like, you see, like, the kid's car and all the kid's stuff, but the whole house is empty. And he very much looks like a 50s dad coming home, except we know that the briefcase is the briefcase that has the $2 million in it. But it's playing with that iconography in a really fun way. But again, so all sorts of beautiful stuff happening in all these bits. However, kind of like what we were discussing with Megalopolis last time, all the same themes that are intellectualized and talked about at great length in Megalopolis, if they had instead been forced to be dramatized through the idea that there's a, and as cliche as this may sound, that the nuclear satellite is falling and it's going to destroy Megalopolis and Adam Driver is going to have to decide whether or not to stay inside of his creation and die or be with his family and his actual creation, whatever, that becomes sort of the... that becomes the funnel, that becomes the prism that focuses things, that tells things how long they should be, how much time should we spend on this idea or that idea, how should these ideas collide with each other, what should they feel like, what should they be energetically, how much screen time can be sustained by one of these ideas gets determined by the by that dramatization, or in the case of The Godfather 1, its genre, by the fact that it is a gangster movie, the fact that it continues to be a gangster movie the whole time, as opposed to Godfather 2, which now that it is no decides essentially that it is not going, as Spielberg says, it is, as Spielberg says, it is more Francis's movie, decides not to be a gangster movie. It is a gangster movie, but not to be one, to be something else, something more abstract, to be an art film, to be a film now that is sort of being created in the lineage of the sequel to a film that won Best Picture and was called a great film by a great by people, as opposed to the pulp novel, which is what it was to begin with. It was a you've read the book. It's a pulp novel.
Oh yeah, it's a pulp novel. And one interesting note about the book, it in the book it does intercut between the Vito storyline and the present day storyline that you see in The Godfather Part 1. The first scene is the wedding scene in The Godfather, and here in Godfather Part 2 in the contemporary storyline, it's the, I forget what it is with Michael's son, his birthday or something like that. Yeah. That's a big gathering where we see all the characters gather together and kind of meet everybody and yada, yada, yada. And so it kind of vaguely mimics the way in which the intercutting worked in the novel. By kind of sort of replicating, you know, this plot of the original, of the contemporary storyline of Godfather 1 for the Michael Corleone storyline here. And you can see the parallels with the horse head scene and the prostitute and kind of all that stuff. But, yes, I don't know where I was going
the fact that the first film kind of maintained that idea, because, again, it was a popular... you know, gangster novel. It was a popular movie about the mafia, or popular book about the mafia. It maintained that idea. It is still about the intrigue of mafia war and murder and backstabbing and all that the whole time, through which, and this is what the film would be praised for, all of these themes about family and divorce, like with the Talia Shire chick being like beat up by her, Talia Shire's character being beat up by her boyfriend Carlo, or her husband Carlo, but because they have kids, he's forced to stay with her, even though they know that Carlo betrayed them for literally years, and they sit on it because, you know, Marlon Brando, Vito Corleone would not want them to kill his daughter's husband, and that's the wedding at the beginning of the movie. Yeah, the whole movie is built around that wedding at the beginning of the movie, and they end up killing Carlo, you know, as soon as he dies at the end of the movie. It contemplates all these ideas above of, you know, of you know, satirizing the American dream. It all these contemporary ideas about divorce. It funnels them through generational unity, schisms between generations. It funnels them through this prism of this gangster movie, which is what imbues them with their tremendous power and resonance. The fact that these beats are being told in, you know, the soldier returning home and being forced. All of who Michael Corleone is funneled through the act of shooting a guy and another guy in the face as a hit to get back at those guys for killing his father. So as much as we want to talk
just
about...
Just like in the past storyline with Vito at exactly. the same time, where we would have seen him shooting the, exactly. The white coat guy.
Exactly, exactly. And that's the thing, is that it remains that all of the themes, all the subtext, all that fancy bullshit that the film got praised for has to work, operate through that and in service of that, which is why it's so fucking good, which is why Alien is better than Prometheus, say, to use as another example, because Alien is a horror movie and Prometheus doesn't know what the fuck it is. and whereas with Godfather 2, what happens? You know, what the fuck happens when you have this gangster movie but you were praised for all of these contemporary themes about divorce and about satirizing the American dream and family and all this other kind of stuff. What happens when you lose those bones, when you lose that latticework that's holding you together, those rails, and you instead end up kind of having carte blanche and all the money in the world? Well, things get a little wonky at that point, and one of the things that happens, and this is the main criticism I have with the experience of watching Godfather 2, is essentially everything in the contemporary storyline that happens in the back half of the movie, which is over an hour long, shouldn't be there because seems to be shit that let me put it this way, it is all very good, but it is all stuff that feels like it's the kind of stuff that people wanted to see in movies in 1974 but really has nothing to do with a gangster movie. That is to say, long dramatic arguments about divorce and the deterioration of a marriage, which would be very in vogue, and we're 5 years away from Meryl Streep and all them winning Oscars for Kramer versus Kramer.
Turns out abortion's still a hot topic.
Yes, abortion. There you go. Throwing that in there. And then finally, and this in most Oppenheimer-y of all, long political hearings that are in some way subtextually evocative of Nixon and of a bunch of other bullshit that's going on. And again, all of those scenes kind of suck ass, you know, in the sense that they're good, but they don't have the energy of any of these other parts of the movie. Like, again, I like the political hearing stuff. It's well done. I like what's-his-name seeing his brother come in, and it all works. But at the same time, that is immediately compressed out of my mind when I walk out of the theater relative to any of the other things that have happened in the movie. But it's the kind of stuff that people, as to quote the person who was praising the film, but I think it is quite damning, this feels like the intellectualization of those themes. All of those themes about how industry and family and all these American institutions are corrupt and murderous at their core, well, when you literalize it into a political hearing, and then, you know...
I also remember where the senator stands up before he needs to leave for his own meeting and makes long statement where this hearing does not reflect that of this Italian American community.
My best friends are Italian Americans, and a great example for this is the senator's arc, which again in the first film, with the Hollywood producer and stuff, very clear what's going on. In this film, I think this is something that the film, by virtue of losing track of the fact that it is a gangster film, it often seems to prioritize meaning over the movie itself. Like, with the horse head and all of those beats involved, we understand what's going on, and therefore it has a resonant power. Whereas the senator, in that first scene, we get it. Michael's gonna fucking get this guy, and they're gonna, like, we get it, and we're on board. But then in the scene with the prostitute, we're not really even fucking sure what happened. Like, is the idea...
It's alluded that he was somehow basically roofied, somebody else killed the prostitute, but then he woke up in the room with her.
It's all implied, again, is all, that is the basic implication of what's going on, and yet it feels weirdly muddled by comparison, because we're not sure why, and if you...
It would have been stronger if it was his daughter. If he would have, now obviously the rape aspect is weird, but if he would have thought that he killed his daughter or killed a woman that was more.
But again, it just, it feels to like defy utility in the sense that the horse head thing feels like the like minimum amount of effort required for these guys, Michael Corleone and these other guys, to get, Vito Corleone, to get what they want, Tom Hagen, to get what they want out of the producer. Everything that's weird, however, weird and muddled and dreamlike about the scene with the prostitute, and this is, I think, the red flag for me, no pun intended, is that all of the imagery is evocative of someone giving birth. That is to say that you see she's laying in the sheets, she has all of this red blood all over her, etc. It's a strong image of a girl giving birth, which then later on, when Michael's sins are visited upon him later on, what's her bitch, Diane Keaton, she fucking says...
what's her bitch, Diane
Keaton? Says, it wasn't a miscarriage, Michael, it was an abortion, and when he first comes home to see her for the first time after all of the time away, she's dressed now all in red, and she's literally like sewing a red fabric thing and all of this, and we use this color throughout, and so I get it, but I feel like there was a priority towards this evocative image, and we have this something, this is something we see throughout Megalopolis, but the prioritizing of this loaded and meaningful image over any coherent understanding really of what's going on as a gangster picture. And then even everything that happens after that with the senator is cool, he's clearly in their pocket, he's on their side, etc. But, you know, it lacks the elemental power of the first film if we're comparing things directly. And I feel like as much as I dig those kinds of meanings, actually, in the film, and that's, I say, I actually really like all the themes about birth and about all of that kind of stuff. However, what is feels like it really weighs the film down is the entire back half, the long political hearings that we don't care. Like, at what point in the first half of the film does any part of your emotional or narrative or intellectual experience of the film demand, make your mind ask the question, you know where I want to see this story go? I want to see him in a big fucking hearing, talk like in long depositions. What I would love to see are depositions.
If you are going to take us into a world where we're going to be in a deposition, make it kind of like My Cousin Vinny. Give us a scene where there's like where
a better courtroom movie.
Al Capone, where Michael Corleone actually like outsmarts the lawyer. It's like, oh, you thought you had this evidence? And not just, anyway.
I guess and that beat happens with the brother thing, which is, again, all left very vague. Everything in the movie is left very vague. Vague to the extent that you get a sense that Francis Ford Coppola, and I think he's admitted as much in certain things, didn't necessarily know 100% what was going on all the time. And you feel that. You feel that in some of the kind of, in some of those scenes. Like, even he said that, like, Clemenza being dead and the armbands. And like, Clemenza, it wasn't the murder. Like, was literally because they were in negotiations with the actor to join the cast until like the day before, and his demands were too high, so they couldn't cast him, the guy who played Clemenza. Yeah. And so then they added that scene with the armbands and the whole black armbands, and like, he had died of a heart attack. It was no heart attack. And like, and so Francis Ford Coppola is like, so I don't know, maybe he did die of heart of natural causes, but like, you know, you get it. Like, and so the point, the point being that you get that in 1974, if you know that critics are going to be looking at your film and assessing it solely based on the amount of Nixonian politics or contemporary divorce drama by weight that you can cram into your movie, then you stick in a whole extra hour of that at the end that gets a bunch of critics and a bunch of people in 1974 to wank off to the back half of the movie and make these insane assertions that it's the equal or even perhaps the better of the first film. Why? Well, in the first film, made me feel all of these ideas about family and America and industry, and then I had this incredible experience, and it got into my soul. Whereas the other film was very distancing and cold, and it was an intellectual kind of didactic meditation on political hearings that made me think a lot about watching the news. And I know that watching the news is the most important thing. Nay, more important, I was going to say, more important than watching movies. Nay, the most important thing. Watching the news and Nixonian politics and etc. Therefore, this film, because it has gangster stuff and Nixonian politics plus a bunch of divorce melodrama, must, by weight, be a superior film in terms of mass, if you're going to put it on a scale, then Godfather Part 1, which is a silly and dumb way of looking at movies. No, the back half of Godfather 2 is really well done. I actually really like a lot of the divorce conversations and all that, and I do dig the beats in the political hearings and everything, and Al Pacino's performance is pretty fucking incredible, and even the stuff with Fredo dying over the course of the next hour after he should have died. And
well, I think that, that makes sense even a little bit. They could have done a little bit better with the pacing, but it does make sense that much like they wouldn't kill the husband character until dad died, they're not going to kill Fredo until mom dies.
Obviously that's the plot reason they don't wait. They wait until, and that's I love all the stuff with the bodyguard guy, who's actually the other guy in The Ref, another one of my favorite films, the Ted Dennis.
Oh yeah, when he hugs, he just goes.
Yeah, well, just that, all that stuff where he tells him, I don't want anything to happen to him while my mother is alive, and then the mother dies, and it just keeps cutting back to the, and it's the same bodyguard who shoots the guy on the stairs in the first film, and he's just looking at Fredo terrified just in the background of every, like every time Fredo walks in and like waves him, he's just like, oh, because he knows he's gonna have to kill him. And then finally they go out on the boat and all that other kind of stuff. But again, it's the kind of thing where I want those scenes. I want the scene where Fredo and Michael's son are forming a bond while fishing and all that other kind of stuff. I want that. But I would like that scene earlier in the film before eventually the contemporary storyline takes us to sunny Cuba and the communist revolution becomes the backdrop for the big operatic assassination shootout, whatever, where Hyman Roth dies and then Fredo is killed and all these other things. And then Michael takes his $2 million in his briefcase with his fedora and his coat, and just like the midpoint scene after the intermission, returns home, say, to his home, and finds it completely empty, Diane Keaton gone, kids gone, but we never find out for sure where they are. Is this just her leaving her mom's house for, you know, a day? Is she gone forever? We don't know. And that's where the movie ends, contrasting that image against Robert De Niro with his whole family gathered around him, having finally achieved this great position as this great patriarch, not only of his community, but his actual family with these four boys. And he has his family around him, and we have seen Michael unravel all of those things in this big operatic sequence in Cuba and all these other things. That film energetically plays really, really well. That's almost the version of Godfather that if you've seen it once or like a long time ago, that you're kind of remembering. And then all the Cuba shit is done in the first hour and a half of the movie, and then there's all that crap you don't remember, where he is just in political hearings and where they're arguing and Fredo is around and doing all the stuff with the son, which is, again, has a really cool subtext to it, because you know Fredo's dead, you know he's dead in the same way that Carlo is around, and they're not killing him, and you're wondering why, because they know they betrayed him, and then they kill him finally in the end. You know, it's happening, it has a cool subtext to it, but all of the different things feel like they are working at cross purposes that perhaps are emphasizing certain meanings or emphasizing, you know, again, certain political ideas within the film, but are not actually serving the energetic experience of watching the movie. They're not actually dramatizing the ideas. It is an intellectualization of those ideas. Anyway, but there you go. What do you think, Taylor?
I think it's a good movie. I definitely agree with you in the that the first movie is better. I definitely think that the first movie is a lot more iconic, things to think about, and kind of you sit and chew on it a little bit longer. I wish that, if anything, of the old timeline, they wish they'd given a little bit more. I think they relied a little bit on the fond memories of the character in the first movie to not really give the character in the second movie of Vito Corleone a little bit more of a personality. And they also do probably lean into the fact that he is a mute child, and therefore he's kind of a quieter adult. He doesn't have that many lines in the first movie.
It is interesting. I was not an unexpected a part of the screening experience was how cold I think some of the De Niro stuff left you, because, and that you invested. I also understand that, like, I think a lot of the contemporary familial drama marriage stuff is also stuff that would probably be more appealing to you in general. But so I get that. But I also think that it occurred to me as well that watching it this time, that stuff, which really stood out to me as amazing when I watched it when I was a kid, felt left me feeling more cold because it felt so diffuse. It felt so separated in time by, and even diffuse narratively, in that I feel like the energy that I want to feel at the moment that he's killing the guy in the white suit with the towel wrapped around his hand is the energy of him killing the guy who killed his father at the beginning or something. And instead, he's killing another guy in a white suit, and so there's a subtextual connection to Don Ciccio, who killed his father and his brothers and his mother in front of him and chased him away, and yet it's not the same guy. And I even remember being a kid, I'm like, wait, is that like the same guy? You know, not the same guy, and it kills him and all that. And then he goes and kills Don Ciccio, which is again another amazing scene where he goes and he slashes him with a knife. Great scene, but energetically the two beats feel like they would be so much more powerful as one beat. Go ahead.
I guess I like the psychological breakdown of Vito Corleone that we get there, because clearly, you know, the moment that he kills the guy in the white suit, the black hand guy, is the moment that he becomes a gangster. Until then, he's just, you know, a guy who's stealing with some friends, they're doing that, and that sets him on the path to being a, let's say, a well-respected and much-feared gangster. And you can see that, and it seems, in the context in which it's going on, pretty extreme action to kill this guy who's only wanting a little bit of money from you, and you actually negotiated with him well to not take much money. But you can tell that as soon as the guy touches his face and he wipes it, it's like, oh, he's not liking that. Wipes his hand away after the gangster touched his face. It's pretty extreme action, but you understand what that extreme action is rooted in, because the guy looks just like the gangster who did his father. And so the way in which he becomes a gangster is psychologically rooted in the trauma of his father being murdered, yada yada.
Seeing another big gangster bully guy in a white suit and deciding that he was going to take him out. And you also see just elementally the idea of the Godfather emerging, the what he is and who. You see even that the guy he kills is this raw, more primal form of a gangster who's literally nothing but a bully who's going around and shaking people down for money. And instead, you see, you know, Vito Corleone take this other approach where he's always exceedingly kind to everyone and good to everyone, and always he repeats
knows
over
how
and
to pay back a favor,
knows how to return a favor, exactly. And that's what it's all about, this system of favors, whereby if everyone is kept in line through this elaborate system of favors, whereby if someone is a bad actor and not into doing favors, you know, they can get taken out. And so
it's all has stuff, this threat of violence just simmering just under the surface, under the surface of just nice politeness.
Exactly.
And that's where
I will help you, and then at some point in the future you will help me, and we will trade favors. And that is how all of this goes. And you just see it built almost like a small business, literally like a small business with the olive oil company and everything. And just to say that, just to wrap up that thought, I was always very smitten with when I was a kid, and yet within the fucking whole movie, I felt somewhat watered down this time. So I was, but go ahead.
I will say, as kind of like a pinpoint scene of all of that, I think it was a great moment of, I think he was buying mangoes or oranges or some sort of fruit, and he goes to pay, and the shopkeeper just goes, oh, no, please, take, and he goes, oh, thank you, let me know if you ever need a favor for me. And it's just like, you could have just, any other person of power could have just very easily been like, oh, thank you, and move on. But it was like that immediate, like, oh, I recognize this goodness. Thank you. I will take care of you as you have taken care of me. You do, just to see just that Godfather idea, building up.
Yeah, no, that idea that if there's someone who's really out of line and doing something that's not good and not Catholic and not whatever, you know, there's a guy you can talk to who can straighten that person out. But as a result, everyone does favors for that guy, because he does favors for them, and how it all just kind of, it's a beauty. And it's the whole scene with the landlord who he, you know,
that's what I was going to get. That seemed like a great baby step of like what that looks like in the bigger space.
It's just such a beautiful, beautiful scene where at no point does Robert De Niro ever get tough or violent or whatever with the guy. First, he comes to him as a friend and he's like, can you help out this old lady? She can't afford the rent, blah, 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 blah. Never threatens him, never is just it, like the guy insults him, throws the money down, just acts like he's just his best friend in the whole world. And then later on the guy comes back to him and he's asked around, and maybe more anecdotes have had the time to accrue in the interim, and he comes back and Robert De Niro again asks nothing of him, says nothing to him, he's remained silent. The guy comes back and says, I didn't know who you were, here's your money back, in fact I'm gonna lower the rent, and he says nothing. $5. Says nothing. $10. And he's like, oh, that would be really generous of you. And I love the look when he says $5. And Robert Jr. just looks away. Oh. Like, you know, like he's like a very aloof with his cigarette. And again, it's like he's getting him on board with the idea that, hey, we're all in this together. We're going to do each other's favors. Don't you get it? And when you see it from that perspective, then the mafia takes on a whole different a whole different thing.
The good mafia king.
The good mafia king, exactly. I don't know. That being said, again,
but it's still rooted in trauma and violence at its core, which is finally cathartically ended when he has the biggest act of his being a big rich gangster finally returns to his hometown as the big guy from New York and finally gets revenge. Yada, yada, yada.
And he says
the thing that Don Cheadle was so afraid of at the very beginning.
Exactly. He was right to be afraid of that.
And yes, he had a kind of spiritual premonition that in fact he would die by the hands of this small, slow boy who doesn't speak, who they were chasing down. Again, it's a really good fucking movie.
Just as a quick statement, having not seen this movie and going in cold and blah, 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 I really thought that up until the moment where the mom threatens the Don to try to save herself, I thought the little boy was going to get, like, pulled into Don Chicho's world and, like, almost, like, taken under the wing. He's like, oh, yes, you think, but then, like, still somehow being betrayed or whatnot. So when he ran, I was like, well, that plot goes right out the window. Idea what's going on now.
Kill that little boy.
Yeah, a much more dangerous and dark storyline for the little boy, Vito, before he gets Vito Andolini.
Yes,
to become Vito Corleone.
Yeah, no, I love that. So I feel like we've gone on for a long time. Godfather 2 is a fantastic, amazing movie. Don't be deterred.
Go check it out.
But it was definitely the first time I saw it in the theater with an audience, and you could kind of feel with clarity that there was something that's wonky about how the movie's laid out relative to the perfection of the first film, relative to the kind of the full dramatization and creative and kind of channeling of all those ideas into a gangster film in that first movie. But it's a really great fucking movie. I don't feel like I'm really saying anything controversial by saying The Godfather 2 is good. So enjoy that, everyone.
It does make me want to give Godfather 3 a chance.
That is a movie I have not revisited in a very long time. And I believe he recently did a final cut.
Re-edit. I think the final cut
that's been re-edited. So maybe we'll have to wait for that to play in a theater or something and go see Godfather 3 again. But no, I mean, amazing. So many amazing parts in Godfather 2. Really glad we got to see that in a crowded theater. Really glad we got to see California Split in a crowded theater. If you haven't seen California Split, please go do it. It is an awesome, hilarious, fun movie. But we can only speculate as to meanings of these films. We, of course, must now consult the spirits. So we, prior to the, because our cat wants to be let inside and is meowing at the door right now. So prior to this, here, I'll let you do that, Taylor. So prior to the movie, we did a tarot draw, and I consulted with the spirits as to what is the greater meanings that we may discern, scry, if you will, from California Split and Godfather 2 to take into our week and into our lives, both us on the Crowded Theater podcast and you at home. And Taylor, turn that card over now. The card
They're always upset.
Hey, it's all right. We won't read the inversion. It's the Magician card. Woo! Hey, look at that. That is both the card that is actually on the front of the Rider-Waite deck I have. And fantastic. So it's on the the second trump in the tarot. So Cliff, what do you think?
The second trump.
Just like the second trump term. Another thing that just suddenly happened since our last week's podcast. I think, I don't know. It's all time is becoming blurry. But no, the Magician is interesting because I feel like this Magician has one hand raised aloft above his head, channeling down spirits, and one hand, if you can see, is pointed directly into the ground as he is bringing his vision into manifestation. And that is one of the things that Francis Ford Coppola definitely fucking did here with this movie, is the Magician does not take a conventional path. It's funny saying Magician. I mean, this card is kind of the card of Francis Ford Coppola, because this card, in the most literal sense, Francis Ford Coppola in his films, the Dracula, the Bram Stoker's Dracula film, really draws direct comparisons between cinema and magic. That it is essentially an illusion, something to be created, like he, in order to kind of create some sense of the uncanny. And he kind of views cinema as an extension of the act of creating magic or of magic tricks. And as we've seen also in Megalopolis, which has recently come out. He has even recently magically transmuted an entire vineyard, and you can see the goblet of wine there on the, it's actually a water goblet on the card, into the movie Megalopolis, a pure, as I described it last time, magical, talismanic object of a movie, which, though it might not work aesthetically, certainly is there to have various profound meanings scribed from it.
I
think Godfather 2 in some way anticipates Megalopolis in a lot of ways. A film that chooses perhaps not to fully dramatize or even genre-itize its ideas or themes in a way that perhaps we would want, but at the same time, we're somewhat willing to overlook those things because we feel that the filmmaker has something he's trying to get over, something he's trying to bring down from the other side, some sort of idea, as you can see him raising aloft his wand, something he's trying to channel from the spirits. And so quite literally, when I look at a film like Megalopolis or Apocalypse Now, I am trying to discern, aesthetic issues aside, what the hell is what is Francis Ford Coppola trying to channel?
Indeed, it's crazy magic. We don't know. Something involving Rome. We know that that pops up in both.
That's true. And he mentioned Rome. He does. The Roman Empire in the second.
When they built the family, built the mafia originally. It was like they named it after like Roman legions or capos or whatever, And also, the magician card refers to California Split, and that Robert Altman we can discern was a magician because. Magicians also smoke the ganja like Gandalf in that one movie, Pipeweed. So that
if you see the magician,
and it's a card too.
It is also a card wreathed in flowers, and obviously the flowers are symbolic of ganja.
There we go. So. And the fact that it is a card and was a card playing movie, you know, you got that.
You got the cards. It's got cards in both things. That's right.
So it definitely applies.
Yes. Mm-hmm. No, another thing. Speaking of magic, we didn't talk about the final scene, which is kind of an act of magic, which is in the final scene of Godfather 2, they bring back the whole cast except for Marlon Brando.
Oh yes.
And they even put a silly wig on James Caan to make him look like James Caan in the first film. So there's some magic right there. And they bring everyone together, and I feel like that scene, in a way, I dig. It's very experimental. It's cool that he brings together the whole cast, and they're anticipating the arrival of Vito Corleone on his birthday. And they have a whole cake for him, and it's a whole scene where they are finding out against the backdrop of Vito Corleone's birthday, which is very interesting, that Pearl Harbor has just been attacked, and that Michael has volunteered to go off to war. So just in case we didn't really tie any more of these ideas into some like American subtext about this is about America and the military-industrial complex, we have that. But it's a really good scene, it's well played, it's all that kind of stuff. But it's interesting that it is the second film here, which we watched and reviewed last week, also had the day that of Pearl Harbor's attack within the text of the film as being something the characters were dealing with.
It was Vito's birthday, we were told.
It was Vito's birthday.
That's apparently, we now know Vito's birthday on what is
December 7th, 1941?
There you go.
Yeah, that is a... It's interesting because, if you couldn't tie those things any more together in a film that is all about birth and creation and babies and all of that kind of stuff and the creation of babies and the death of babies and all of that kind of weird, crazy shit, you have the birthday of Vito Corleone is the same day as, and the day that Michael is the day that Pearl Harbor is attacked and Michael goes off to war, et cetera, et cetera.
But isn't he, coming back from the military or recently?
In the first film, he arrives in his military uniform at the beginning of the first film, and everyone, he's separated himself from that side of the family, and then all of the business with his father draws him back in once his father gets shot.
Yeah,
this is presumably 4 years plus before the beginning of the first Godfather that we see them. Yeah,
that makes sense.
And really incredible scene, really good to see James Caan in there pushing people around, getting physical. Missed that in this movie. And which might even be an interesting segue into the final segment of the show. Cliff, we have to decide who is the most jacked person in California Split and or The Godfather? We had a good idea earlier, but does the Full Metal Jacked Award go to this week?
Probably. Hey, even though it is tempting to, you know, grandfather in Arnold Schwarzenegger from the movie 2 years prior that Robert Altman did and say that counts for 74. I still think the honor has to really go to
remember how jacked he was? He was almost jacked enough to pull that off.
Absolutely. Yeah, exactly. to bridge space and time, past and future, just like the Quetzal Cataract.
That's right. Watch Robert Altman's The Long Goodbye, and you will see a full bodybuilding era, juice to the gills, Arnold Schwarzenegger walk into a scene as a heavy for like 10 seconds.
Yep. I think he has a mustache, too. So
yeah.
Super
and they
weird.
Take off their clothes, too. The crazy guy.
Oh, yeah. You see everyone disrobes there, so Arnold is meant for that. Yeah. But no, I think the award probably has to go to the young and virile Robert De Niro. I think his role, first of all, since we don't really see anyone with their shirt off in these movies, we have to go by the second proxy, which is head size.
Mm. We see him with his shirt off, though. He is very lean.
Okay.
He's not actually cut.
He jumps off
lean.
The buildings, too, as he's like,
oh, yeah, exactly. Yeah, that's what I was going to bring up. It's like he plays Vito Corleone, basically, and he shoots Vito Corleone, Francis Ford Coppola, as basically a Batman, a superhero. Mm-hmm. He's not just a gangster. He's a superhero gangster, righting wrongs and all that stuff.
Sneaking from rooftop to rooftop.
Sneaking from rooftop to rooftop, fought like Batman, following the, or the Punisher, more likely, following the gangster that he wants to take out. And the physicality of his performance for Vito Corleone, because he's trying to riff off of Marlon Brando before with the big jowls, the big cotton ball cheekbones.
Yeah.
His performance is mostly about making his head and jawline appear as prominent and large as possible. So sticking his chin and head forward. And as we all know, head size, best proxy for jackness.
Absolutely.
Goes to young virile Robert De Niro. Excellent. And one other funny fact about the Robert De Niro storyline in Godfather 2 that is somewhat related. Clips from Godfather 2, specifically the plot line from when Robert De Niro is insulted by the white-coated gangster to when he shoots the white-coated gangster dead, was used in a scientific experiment measuring testosterone levels. Specifically, they had measured testosterone levels in a variety of people prior to watching that sequence, and then they watched that sequence and they measured gain or rise in testosterone levels after that sequence. And what they reliably found is men who had already naturally higher T had their testosterone levels enormously boosted by watching that sequence. Men who, at baseline, had very low T levels actually had their testosterone levels reduced by watching that sequence. And for women, the effects were weird and different, but for the men, I think that is interesting.
That's incredible. So what we're saying is that we can actually juice yourself up with masculine movies, is what you're saying.
Specifically in The Godfather 2, in general.
And it's amazing
this
is just coming up this deep into the podcast. I feel like that anecdote, if it was about Godfather 2, was engineered for this podcast and this particular moment. It combines jackness, T levels, science, Godfather 2, and all of that together. Where did you hear this? Where do you remember
In some article sometime read on the internet an infinite time ago.
That's funny. I wonder if they used other sequences or just that.
Just that for this experiment.
Interesting. That's the most fascinating thing I've learned about Godfather 2 in this whole time. That's fantastic. Well, cool. Well, you can't end on any note better than that. Watch Godfather 2 and it will fill your balls with more testosterone.
Unless you're a low T soy boy, in which case it will actually diminish your testosterone. Yeah. Somehow, because I assume because they wouldn't be able to relate to the Robert De Niro character and would instead feel threatened and offended by it somehow.
Yes, cowardly and meek deceptive and serpentine, etc. I get it.
Over the tongue.
That's right.
Don't trust men who drink Soylent.
That's what we're saying. Take that. All right, y'all. Well, I think we have talked these movies to death. So 1974, as it turns out, kind of a weird year for movies, 50 years ago, and yet, all of these films more relevant in some ways today than they were in their own time.
Flash forward to 2074. Hopefully we can have the same similar type of conversation.
What will people be saying? Yes, that's true. What will people be saying about Oppenheimer in 2074, I wonder. Who knows? Anyway, for the Crowded Theater Podcast, I'm Kyle.
I'm Taylor.
I'm Cliff.
And we will see y'all at the movies. Once. Woo!